Hello, posterity. Today is the 1st of July, 2016. My name is Lucy Saxon. I'm here at Swarthmore Public Library with Nancy Webster, who has lived in this area
since 1952. I was born in Haverfordford, but we moved to Swarthmore in 1952.
I never knew that. And is also a historian and knows about many subjects. I think that thinking about this interview, it was very difficult to home in on specific areas because there are so many areas of your expertise. So I think maybe the most important thing that no one can find elsewhere is your personal experiences. So some of the questions I have are starting there. And if there are other subjects that you want to cover, mm-hmm. please steer us. So you were born in Haverford.
I was born in Havertown,
Delaware
County Hospital. And in 1946, the year after all the boys came home from the war, so I'm the front end of the baby boom. And I've lived in Swarthmore since, as I say, 1952.
And can you tell me a bit about your parents, your family? Have they been in the area for generations?
My father's family were Quakers who came to Virginia in 1660. And on Kent Island, which was part of Virginia but is now part of Maryland. And when William Penn got his land grant here, I think they probably wanted to be part of the majority. And they moved up to Pennsylvania and got land in what is now Chester County and New Castle County, Delaware. And we still have 9 of the family farms in the family. My cousins have them. And our end of the family lost their land in the 1929 crash because my great-grandfather co-signed everybody's loans for them. So when they couldn't pay, he had to. And so then my grandfather and my father went into chemical engineering work for Sun Oil. So I'm a 14th generation Quaker on dad's side. And on mother's side, I descend from quite a few of the Mayflower families and the people that kicked around in New England. I'm very proud of them because they moved out of Massachusetts Bay, which was so restrictive, to the wilds of Connecticut as soon as they could, which was where all the fringy people were. And so a long line of high-thinking education. Most of them taught college and were lawyers. And from the 1820s on, in my mother's side of the family, women went to college.
That's unusual.
A couple of times they went with their brothers. They sat through the classes. They, of course, never got a diploma, but they were college-educated women, and they were very much feminists before there were feminists. I have several ancestors that were at the Seneca Falls Conference from mom's family. Her mother was a suffragette and worked with Alice Paul. Chained herself to the White House railings.
This is your grandmother?
My grandmother, yeah.
What was your grandmother's name?
Her name was Ruth Holly Cabine Reddington.
So your mother was named for her?
Yes, my mother was Ruth Holly Reddington.
But I didn't know your mother was Ruth.
No, they didn't want to have any two Ruths in the family, so mother was always Holly.
Was called Holly.
So, with the liberal approach of both sides of the family, I can see why my parents felt they had a lot in common when they met in college. And they both went to Syracuse, so they met in college.
Oh.
Dad had a track and a scholarship and a football scholarship to Syracuse. Oh. But everybody else in his family went to Penn State because we had a great uncle who taught at Penn State and they got it tuition free.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Great uncle would get you in tuition free.
Yeah.
That's pretty nice.
Back in those days.
Yes, I don't think that would fly these days. I'm pretty sure it has to be a parent.
So our family probably too much valued an academic background and academic credentials. That was what my family thought was the best you could achieve. And I, having lived a fairly long life now, I think there are other things equally important, but they weren't emphasized in my childhood. So,
what else do you think is equally important to you?
respect for everyone else, whatever walk of life they're in. Not that anyone was disrespectful, it was just somehow if you had brains, you were thought superior, and that's not true. I think the superior people are those who are kind, and those who are generous, and those who treat others, as the Golden Rule says, the way you would like to be treated. When you're young, that's so simple, and you don't think, oh, it's got to be more complicated than that. But you get older, and you realize, no, that's what it really is about.
It really is simple.
So, and my parents were not unkind at all, but it just wouldn't occur to them to pack food on Thanksgiving for people that didn't have it or things like that. They would have generously donated money if you asked for it.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't have occurred to them to go down and do it.
Mm-hmm. And what did your father, he was in chemical engineering?
He was a chemical engineer, yeah. he graduated, at those times you didn't need a graduate degree the way you do now. So he went straight to work for his father's company, as did most of his brothers, and that was Sun Oil. And, you know, Delaware County, I think we're probably pretty typical, but Delaware County in those days, a lot of the businesses weren't exactly patriarchal, but they were. the Pugh family ran it very much as a family business. And if your family did well and had a good reputation with them, they would hire the next member of your family. But woe betide whoever messed up, because then your family would be on the blacklist forever.
Oh,
so my grandfather, with an eighth grade education, because he had to drop out of school and take care of the family as the oldest son, my grandfather Webster had only eighth grade diploma, but he ended up the financial vice president of Sun. And he had been, his thing was money. Dad's was chemical engineering. And my father had seven brothers, and they all fought in World War II except my father. And my father always felt rather guilty about that, I think. But he went down to sign up. I found this out years later, right before he died. He went down to sign up to fight three different times, and they wouldn't let him because he had over 3,000 patents of chemical engineering to his name, earned on company time, so they didn't belong to him, but they were in his name. And some of them enabled the airplane fuel to last longer, and therefore we could do the long-range bombing missions. So the government felt he was much more valuable where he was in Sun Oil, and they didn't want him as one more
casualty.
Private. Yeah. But, you know, all his life he felt really guilty about that, even being Quaker and everything, because his brothers had faced what he had not. Interesting.
And they were all Quaker?
No, some of them were Methodists. My father's mother was Methodist, so we, you know, people went different ways.
Aha. Uh-huh. So they were raised.
They were raised
in both or either.
They were raised in both. My father was always Quaker. We belonged to Old Haverford Meeting when I was a child, and one of my first memories is that there were three men. It was a very small meeting. There were three able-bodied middle-aged men, and the three of them built the addition that still stands and is the major addition to Old Haverford. And my job at age 4 or 5 was to run around and pick up all the bent nails when they were roofing. And so that, you know, if they bent one, they just throw it on the ground. And I can still remember that. And I can remember some things from the old meeting house. But and we lived on Marthard Avenue right in back of the school. And I can remember watching the band and the drum majorettes. I thought that's what I wanted to be when I grew up. He was very active Quaker. I think, you know, most of his father's family were very active Quakers, and I think that, you know, kept him in the faith.
Mm-hmm.
And they are still around. Most of my Webster family goes to Hokesson Meeting because that's where the farms are. So, and the new farm, 1796 means the new farm.
Oh. Naturally.
But that is a whole way of life that's really getting completely lost from this area. We are now...
There are a few farms remaining.
Very few. And they're
Are there any farms in Delaware County? Do you know?
A couple. But almost all of them are not active anymore.
There was one that was almost a farm museum out near Cheney.
Yeah.
I don't even know if it's still there.
And there is, for want of any other farm museum, the Concord Historical Society has kept the Pierce Willits House, and which the Garnet Valley High School and schools, and the campus that is the library, and the, see, that was all the Pierce Willits farm. And he was U.S. Secretary of Agriculture somewhere in the 20s, I've forgotten when, and did a lot to promote the better pasteurization of milk and so on and so forth. So we've always been a big milk county until recently.
So you moved to Swarthmore at age six.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What was
College
it like?
Avenue. Well, we lived up on the hill.
The
dead end
meaning
of
the
Elm
campus.
Avenue. And we were the only non-college family around. Everybody else was college faculty.
What was that like?
Well, at first I didn't. I mean, they were just people. When I got older, I felt really weird. And when my two sisters and I were applying to colleges, my father always said, "Why don't you girls want to go to Swarthmore?" And it was because we had grown up with all the faculty brats, and we knew the faculty, and, you know, you want to go somewhere else. But he was right. It was a very good school. We should have. So we had a big house, very big house, and we have a very steep front yard, which became the sledding hill for Swarthmore whenever it snowed. And you would start up at our house and go down our front lawn, 605 Elm Avenue.
605 Elm Avenue.
And then you pulled a hard right and went down the rest of Elm Avenue into the college woods. And if there was enough snow, you could get all the way down to the creek. And if the creek were frozen and you had enough momentum that your sled would go out on the creek and you could go quite a long way on the ice. So that was what everybody did. College used to come and put cinders on the snow sometimes, but they would get booed by all the kids, so they would do it at the very last. And the other thing we used to do is we used to gather in the college meadow, of which there's not a whole lot left.
I was going to say, where's the meadow?
Okay, if you go past the field house mm-hmm. and past Crum Ledge, it's a little dirt road that heads down towards the creek, and the paved road turns and goes across the railroad and
mm-hmm.
over by the dorms.
Yeah.
So if you went down the little dirt road, there is the college meadow.
And where the little stones were, the little college henge or whatever.
And that was the community gathering place for ice skating. And the adults, the college would put all of its tree trimmings down there and have big bonfires. And so we always had plenty of wood to warm up around. You went and it was flat, so you could ice skate. And parents would come bearing hot donuts and chocolate and stuff like that. And so you got too cold, you went, stood by one of the fires and drank. So it was very much a small town, very much. And we used to do a lot of community singing. And we would carol sing around Swarthmore. People always were caroling around Swarthmore. People would go May Daying. Nobody does that anymore. Where we would take flowers and hang them on the doorknobs of older residents who didn't have gardens anymore, celebrate spring. And we carried the little UNICEF boxes. When Halloween, people are afraid to make homemade stuff. We knew who made the best popcorn balls and who made the best brownies. You go to all over town, so you got the best food. And various families would have haunted houses, and nobody had to worry about being beaten up and having the UNICEF quarters stolen or anything. And something that's now people have parties at their house, but I'm sure there were problems out there. But growing up in this town, your parents told you had to obey any adult that told you something reasonable. And you also knew if you didn't behave yourself, it would get back to your family. So, you could walk down the street and people could practically tell you what you'd had for breakfast. It was closely related. It had a lot of good aspects to it. You felt very secure as a kid. You knew there was a big bad world out there, but it didn't seem to affect you. Now, of course, I was not black.
Do you think it was really different for African Americans in town?
But I think you should interview some of them. I would suggest any of the Colemans. Mr. Coleman was the janitor at the school, but he was like everybody's granddad. if you ran out of lunch money and you had to borrow from somebody, you went to Mr. Coleman.
Really?
If you got beat up on the playground, you went to meeting your teachers, you went to Mr. Coleman.
That's so interesting, because when I was at SRS, which was the elementary school, decades later, when I was going to school here, it was Mr. Pauling, who was also black and also the nicest person in the school, who was, you know, who took care of you when you were sick.
Well, I just know that everybody knew and loved the Colemans. He had six kids.
Mm-hmm.
He himself, I think, didn't finish high school, but he put all of his kids through law school and med school and
wow.
so on. And he was just, you know, somebody you could just really trust.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, but of course, as you know, there was a ghettoized part of town
where I now live.
But it was called Scrapple Hundred.
Scrapple Hundred.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yes. In Delaware, what we would call townships are called hundreds. And that was the nasty nickname for that part of town.
Hmm.
Because it was like, oh, well, all they do is the scrapple is the leavings from slaughtering pigs and so on.
Right.
And of course, you know, the park right across from your parents' home was where the black elementary school was.
Except that I hadn't known it was an African American school until you told me that a week or two ago.
Yeah.
I knew
well,
it was a school.
Because there was segregation, and it was national, and there was segregation here.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I went to school, that had ended, even though it had not ended. It had ended in Swarthmore.
That school burned down in
1929,
I think.
Yeah. And I don't know when it ended in Swarthmore. All I know is that we were integrated long before the Supreme Court rulings for the nation.
Interesting.
But I have a feeling if you grew up African-American in this town, you might have a different view of it.
It's interesting because a lot of the things that you're sharing, I feel very much the same about. I still feel that everyone knows what I had for breakfast. And
The other thing, too, is everybody was Republican. Everybody.
Oh, that's over.
My mother was one of five Democrats in the town. And one of my earliest memories was my parents arguing over politics. And because both of them were active, Dad was a very active Republican, but he was a Rockefeller Percy Republican, which doesn't mean anything maybe to your generation, but there was once a thinking liberal part of the Republican Party.
So my mother tells me.
and my mother was a Democrat, and they would go off and vote, and we knew they were canceling out each other's votes, in essence. But they always voted. They made sure we realized that it was our duty to always vote and always turn up. And the one thing that my mother really regretted when she died was that she had felt she was well enough, I could take her in a wheelchair to vote in the primaries. She died at the end of May. And so it ruined a 70-year voting record when she didn't vote in the last primary. But that's the League of Women voter in her. So.
Absolutely.
But I haven't missed one yet, so we'll see.
Well done. I was about to knock on wood, but I don't want to mess up the sound quality. So, who were the people that you interacted with as a child in town that were interesting and notable?
Mm.
Other than Mr. Coleman.
There was a family by the name of Bell, Colin Bell, and he was very high up in AFSC.
American Friends Service Committee.
And his wife, Elaine, and he had represented them around the world and lived here. And I was thinking of him in particular because he used to make polite derogatory comments about our 4th of July parade, about, well, you really have to be a country for 500 years before there's anything worth celebrating, and so on. He was English, and he liked to twit us occasionally. I learned a lot about how fortunate I was from hearing the things that they were doing around the world. And the same thing was true with the Edwards family, Janet Alexander's parents. he ended up, I think, president of the AFSC at one point, and she was secretary for many years. And from hearing what they were doing and where they were helping, I learned a lot about emerging Africa. I learned a lot about Southeast Asia. I learned a lot of things. And my mother's mother this is the intellectual part again, she sat us all down when each of us turned 12 and made us read the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, the Book of Mormon, Confucius, Jainite writings, and she wanted us to understand the great religions of the world, because she said, you girls are going to be part of a global world and not everybody thinks the way we do, and you need to know how they think and why. Which I think, there's the suffragette, or, you know, being very, and so when all this has been talking about ISIS and so on, I know what's in the Quran. I've read it a number of times. I know what's in it. I know what's not. And it does help to understand other cultures. But it was funny growing up in this insular town, and we had one teacher in 12th grade who was a flamingly liberal Democrat and active committee man over in Marple. And he used to try to talk to us about, you Republican children, you don't understand, blah, 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 blah. So we had this secure place to grow up, but I was aware of the currents and other problems. And another thing that did that is Swarthmore, not only not in Swarthmore, but not anywhere near Swarthmore, were any hotels. So the college always had visiting scholars and other people coming to give speeches or whatever, and they had nowhere to put them. They did not have the, now the college has a couple of houses that they can put people in, but they didn't have that either. So at the request of the college, we started housing people. And when
your family.
Occasionally, very occasionally, yeah.
That's
and so the Prime Minister of Nigeria, the first Prime Minister of Free Nigeria, stayed in our house for a couple months. And
that's quite a long time.
People for all around the world. And that, too, made us very aware, because we would sit over tea in the kitchen and talk about things. And, you know, we were included even as kids, but mostly we listened. And so there was this stream of people of all different colors and persuasions, and our babysitter was a Christian Arab, and I remember seeing on Easter the pictures of Jerusalem, and he was saying, there's my house, I can never go home because it's in the wrong quarter. We're Arabs, so the Jews and the Christians don't trust us. We're Christians, so the Arabs and Jews don't trust, you know, his family was an outcast to everyone. And so that's got to have had much more of an effect than I consciously think, but it was an interesting upbringing. And I'm just glad that we didn't have all this fear of kidnapping. I mean, I'm sure it was as real as it is now, but you didn't feel threatened as a kid. You could play in the street. You could play outside, and when Mrs. Pearson rang the cowbell or my mother shouted, everybody knew it was time for everybody to go home. You know, you didn't
Who
have
was Mrs. Pearson?
Frank Pearson was in my class. He taught economics at the college, and they lived one block over. Had two boys, John and Frank. John is now teaching at Cambridge in England. And Frank is head of major environmental studies out in Prescott, Arizona. So, but you know, they were just the local kids. And then my best friend moved away, and I was the only girl my age that end of town. So.
Do you know roughly, this would have been 1950s, yeah. Do you know what the population of Swarthmore was?
No, but I think George Alexander has done all that. Remember when he did all those statistics?
Swarthmore by the numbers.
Yeah. I think he would know. And if not, you can get it off of the census pretty easily. Yeah. I don't. Again, like now, it was a certain amount in the summer. And then when the college students come back, the town sort of doubled. I think now it's like one-third to the town. But, the town's a little bit bigger, but the houses were all built. There are not that many new houses and so on. So, and most people worked for the big industries along the river or in town.
Most people who lived in town?
Most people who lived in Swarthmore either worked for the big industries like Scott, Westinghouse, Sun Oil, or they commuted in town and were architects and lawyers and people like that.
So if they worked in the industries, were they laborers? Were they
we
would call corporate now?
They would be corporate. They would either be, executive level, or like my dad, research. My dad ended up head of research and development for Sun Oil. Mm-hmm. And he had three different labs. He had one in Ohio, one at Marcus Hook, and the big thing downtown.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm keeping you from your questions, but there's one other thing I would like to say.
Please.
My father, although brought up by Quakers, someone, and I think I know whom, but I don't know for sure, in our family, was very bigoted and very racist. And my father grew up with a certain amount of those demeaning comments as part of his surroundings. So both my parents being liberal, I think it was a bigger stretch for my dad. My mom's family always was very liberal. And my father really didn't like persons of color. And when we brought friends home from school, it made him uncomfortable. But my father, and I respect this deeply, I wasn't terribly close to my father, but I respect this deeply, that he could draw a line between people he would hang out and have a beer with and what was fair. And what was fair is you should be able to have a job you were able to hold, and you should be able to participate in community things if you had the talent or the time. And so he was the first person to cast African American in the Players Club.
Players Club of Swarthmore on Fairview Avenue.
And we got threatening phone calls. We got garbage thrown on our lawn. We got our cars marked up because people didn't like this. But Dad's feeling was the man was the best who tried out. And I always admired that my father could put his own personal feelings aside and do what was right. And that, and if I'd inherited any of that, I've inherited it from him more than anyone. And the same thing at Sun Oil. I don't know that he was the first, but he was the first to have more than one token person of color in his department. And it being research and development, this was important because these were higher paid jobs. These weren't out on the line. And at the end of the 60s, there was a group called BEDCE, B-E-D-E-C, and I've forgotten what it stands for, but they were kind of the Malcolm X radical followers following up on the civil rights and demanding equal jobs and so on. And they went and they picketed the Sun Oil executive building downtown, and everybody went into a tizzy. And for some reason, I think I know why, they picked my father. My father was not terribly articulate. He was not good at schmoozing and talking to people. He was rather abrupt. But they sent him down to negotiate with this picket line. So Dad went down, and I'm told by an onlooker that he said, okay, what do you want? And they said, we want to have at least one quarter of all the jobs that our college degree or higher level in the company be for black people. And Dad said, okay, who do you want me to fire? Because he had 38% in his department. And so at a time when this was a huge upheaval, just as it is now, and at a time when, you know, the first black family to try to move out of Scrapple 100 over on Princeton Avenue, and you've probably seen about that because I talked to Sue Edwards into writing a two-part story for the Swarthmoreian, this was pretty darn liberal. And as I say, Dad wouldn't necessarily make personal friends with people, but he felt a man had a right, or a woman, to do what they were capable of doing. So I'm sure there were other people like him in Swarthmore. They just didn't raise their heads too often. And we had all the swimming pool controversy. We had the housing controversy. One of the memories of meeting when I was young is that, for those who aren't Quaker, Quakers do business by a meeting of everyone. And if it isn't settled unanimously, they adjourn the meeting and re-meet until they come to consensus. I think they had an adjourned meeting for 3 months. And I remember Dad coming home. It was summer. It was hot, sticky. And he would take a shower. He'd grab a sandwich. And he and Mother would go over to the meeting house for the adjourned meeting. Because it was split. Like, do you quit the swim club in protest, or do you stay in the swim club and chisel from within and try to get them to accept families that are of different races and backgrounds?
What year was this approximately?
I would say 61, 62. I'm not really sure. You'd have to look it up.
So kind of late.
Yeah. So Swarthmore, you know, and it, every once in a while, you can still see some of that old racism.
Oh, sure.
And
Nobody's immune.
And so, anyway, I just wanted to say, because he was the first person in Players Club to have a woman assistant director. It was definitely an all-man's club.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I don't think it's because he had three daughters. He really wasn't pleased at having daughters. He really wanted sons, and he was trying to cover that up, but all three of us knew it. And but there were women of considerable ability who wanted to direct plays. And again, Dad had that, well, not in my private life, but this is public life, and everyone should have a break. And I always admired that, because this country would run a whole lot better if we behaved like that. Nope, you don't have to make friends with people you treat decently.
For posterity, can you repeat your father's name?
Yes.
We've been speaking about him?
Morris, I've spelled Maurice, L. Webster Jr.
And when was he born?
Dad was born 1918.
And what year
September 5th, 1918.
What year did he pass away?
Oh, now that's hard. 2004, 2005.
I didn't know it was that late.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't living in Swarthmore at that point. He was living over in Medium. My parents got divorced in 1970. So,
how old were you?
I was in I had just gotten out of college. I was in grad school.
Let's go back to college. What was it like to go away to college as a woman at that time? Did all your women friends go to college?
Yes. I would say probably about 98% of the graduating class of Swarthmore did, and I probably think still does. My parents' marriage had become very unhappy, and in those days, you stayed together for the children, which in our case did not do anybody any favors. So I felt as if I was escaping jail. But you know, it's also you want to get out on your own. You want to be a person on your own. And it's not that Swarthmore felt smothering. It's just like didn't really give you room to spread your wings and fly. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate. I got accepted by the college that was my first choice, and never regretted it, even in the middle of exam period. And my younger sister did not have a strong feeling of where she wanted to go, so she went to a family college that was sufficiently far away for her to feel it, and that was University of Wisconsin. My older sister went to, isn't that terrible? One of the Seven Sisters, and it starts with M. I'm sorry, I can't even think of it now. Funny hole in my brain.
Mount Holyoke?
Yes, Mount Holyoke, thank you.
The only one I could think of.
Yes. She went to Mount Holyoke. And I think we deliberately wanted to go physically far away. Our parents said it had to be this side of the Mississippi because of travel costs and time, unless there was a youth college that offered something that nobody else offered and we wanted to do it. So, the younger two of us went on to grad school. My older sister did not. She married and had kids and started out on a different life. And I loved college. I think it's wasted on the young, because it was the first time I really had any kind of social life, because I was part of the nerd gang in high school. So, yeah.
What did you study?
I studied history, American history, and archaeology and anthropology, and I graduated magna from Harvard with a double degree in American history and archaeology. Highly useful. And my father worried about me because he said, how are you going to earn a decent living if you don't teach? And so periodically through my life I would say, see Dad, I'm gainfully employed and I didn't teach. But I have taught part-time, and now that I'm retired I find I'm teaching through the Rhodes Scholar stuff. So he was probably right. I did end up teaching. My older sister went into government public service, and she was town clerk of her community for many years. My younger sister is a nurse.
Where did your older sister live?
She lived in the various suburbs of New York City while her husband was getting his master's degree in teaching. and they lived mostly in Chappaqua once they were settled. Once they were divorced, she stayed on there, and then she married again, lived in Salt Lake City, and now she's back near her oldest daughter in Connecticut. My younger sister and I have kind of hung around this area.
So she's still around the county?
She's in Upper Darby, yes.
Upper Darby. Neat.
And you'll notice how many Swarthmoreans come back to Swarthmore. Have you noticed that?
I'm one of them. Yeah, there are a good number. I think this may be a good place to pause and start a second interview.
Okay.
Because we have about 45 minutes on this one.
Oh, okay.
So rather than interrupt.
Do you need to talk so much?
No, this is great. Thank you so much.
I'm tired.
Thank you. And now is the part.
I want to say something about Irma Zimmer. I mean, you're saying people that influenced us.
Irma Zimmer. I'll make a note to come back to you.
Did you talk to Guy Smith? Will you be talking to Guy Smith?
Do you have a contact for him?
Well, gee, he's still the lawyer for the township. Is it for the... Well,
I'll look into getting...
If not, the Delaware County Lawyers Association will. He was mayor for quite a long while.
Yes, we were talking about him yesterday.
And I'm not quite sure what's wrong with his younger daughter. I think she had cerebral palsy. But the town came and, you know what I say if I say patterning? There was a time when people who had polio or cerebral palsy, all that was thought that if you moved the arms and the legs in patterns that were natural, that eventually the brain would relearn how to send those messages. But it meant that you had to do it a lot every day, and it meant a lot of people.
Post-polio.
I remember doing it for several people in the town, and I think Guy's daughter, I fell into that. I didn't do it for her, but... a couple of my classmates who have siblings whose polio really hit here.